It's a particular pleasure for me to be able to convene this meeting on lessons learned from Georgia and Ukraine. Even the title, who would have guessed we would have this title even a few years ago. As many of you know, the Institute has taken a real interest in the subject of what some of our colleagues call nonviolent conflict for a number of years now, ever since we discovered that's what it was called in the aftermath of what happened in Serbia. We didn't know it during those events. And we have taken an interest in this subject in part in collaboration with Freedom House, with whom we jointly sponsored one of our first meetings on nonviolent conflict some years ago. We're missing, so far, our Ukrainian contingent, as you may have noticed. I can account for Sergei Taran. He was delayed last night by being bounced from a flight. We believe he is on his way here as we speak, and we'll hope that he arrives in time to make his presentation. And I suppose Corey Welt has just been delayed a bit. As a result, we're going to turn to Georgia first. Georgia was first in any case, I think. So, and focus on Georgia for a little while, and then eventually move to Ukraine as quickly as we are able to. I don't do long formal introductions of people. We're trying to get some bios reproduced for you. But I'll just say that Georgi Kandalaki, whom I've only met today for the first time, he prepared a paper for the Institute, Sight Unseen. Highly recommended, but sight unseen. And his credentials are the perfect credentials for giving his paper. He was activist and student, a year as a journalist, and now on the president's staff. And that seems to me the quite a career trajectory. Maybe I'll do the introductions sort of one by one since there are so many people. Georgi, the floor is yours.
Thanks very much indeed. Should I speak from there? Yeah, from
either place, I think. The cameras don't have a preference.
Thanks, Dan, very much indeed. Well, thanks for inviting me here. I'm very pleased to be here. We've discovered what Dan mentioned that was discovered here a couple of years ago. We discovered that, if I might call that, in early 2003 when a guy named Slobodan Djinovic, whom Dan might know well, came to Georgia and was talking about their experiences. And we got very excited, and then basically we decided to do the same, to put it in a very, very simple story. When some Western observers, some Georgian observers, and particularly Russian observers, when they try to explain why a revolution happened in Georgia, they say that, you know, Georgians were fed up with their government because there was so much corruption, because there was so much economic collapse. And I see Slobodan here. They say that Germans were simply fed up. Yes, that's right. That's true. All of that is true. But all of that is present in many other countries, and particularly in the former Soviet Union as well. So why Georgia was the first in sort of this political space where the nonviolent democratic breakthrough took place? I'll try to answer that question, and I'll also try to answer why all that was nonviolent. And I'll briefly list all the actors and their nature and role that played role in our case, and then elaborate on them in more detail. So there were a number of actors and factors that came together at a specific point that made the revolution in Georgia possible. First of all, it was nature of the regime that we had in Georgia, known as under the term Shevardnadze regime. In political theory terms, that would fit somewhere in between liberal in post-totalitarianism and classic autocracy. It is indeed credit of Mr. Shevardnadze that he allowed certain freedoms to be established at some point, but the important thing to bear in mind is that he did that not out of his convictions, but out as part of some political calculations, that he was trying to, on one hand, outmaneuver his political opponents, and on the other hand, earn some credentials or capitalized on his past image in vis-a-vis his Western partners. Then, of course, was Mikhail Saakashvili, our current president and sort of my current boss, with his National Movement Party, and his major achievement was that he managed to sort of radicalize the political space and involve groups and segments of the society into politics that were previously blocked from participation. And another thing that he did was to step into politically protected areas, so-called politically protected areas, where no opposition activity had ever been allowed before. Then was Kmara, and I was there, of course. Major credit of Kmara is that it managed to, particularly young people, to break apathy towards, let's say, participation. You know, opinions vary on how what exactly was role of Kmara, but I think that states our major achievement, because numbers-wise, it was not a dominant actor, as well as no party was dominant actor numbers-wise. And moreover, when we were starting, or when Mr. Saakashvili was starting his party, we anticipated that the major battle, let's say, would take place this year in 2005, when Shevardnadze's term was expiring. And as you know, in 2003 we had parliamentary elections, which we hoped would become sort of a step forward for the upcoming struggle. Civil society is the next important actor. I suggest that in various writings, a role played by civil society has been exaggerated, while just couple NGOs played very important roles, such as Liberty Institute or the International Society for Fair Elections and Democracy. The whole sector largely remained an elitist phenomenon and never exceeded some narrow circle of English speakers who could write reports to foreign donors. After just couple of well-known activists from the civil sector joined government, everybody started talking about crisis there. Then comes Rustavi II, the free media at large. What can I say? It was also established in the period when Shevardnadze was trying to outmaneuver his political opponents, which were the warlords that ousted Georgia's first president, Tsviat Gamsakhurdia, the first nationalist president. And on another hand, Mr. Saakashvili and late Prime Minister Tvania were in government, and they had their own agenda. They were helping free media to grow out of their own political considerations and as part of their political ambitions, basically. Now we'll move. When we were reviewing draft for my first draft, I think Dan asked, should U.S. government or other international actors help groups like Kmara? Yes, my answer is yes, but with caution and with more sort of, let's say, review and confidence. And the aid should be more indirect, and by indirect, I don't think what most of you thought, and that is sort of what we call democracy promotion and all that. And I'll speak about that in the end of my presentation. As I said, the kind of regime that we had in Georgia I couldn't find exact classification for that. But important thing about it was that Shevardnadze never had, or nobody at all in post-Soviet Georgian politics ever had absolute power, because when Shevardnadze was invited to return to Georgia by the warlords, he had to face them, and in his effort to sort of create some kind of political space, he allowed certain freedoms. when he succeeded in curbing his opponents, he was very much enthusiastic and thirsty, I would say, for Western funding. And for that, he had to cultivate his reformist image. And he needed people who could, let's say, speak the same language with his Western partners, some of whom trusted him to the very end. And so the so-called Giovanni Saakashvili team, as it was described for years, was chosen for that job. Shevardnadze rightly claims in his various interviews after the revolution credit for all his freedoms, but again and again, he in various interviews, he suggested that that was a mistake, that he failed to implement measures that would make what they call, particularly in Russia, the so-called managed democracy possible, with what he is increasingly entertained himself in last years of his rule. Anyway, he thought that all these actors that were not part of the system could be easily contained, that they couldn't go farther than writing, you know, complaints or just reports to some foreign international organizations, and so forth. But with time, the system started to erode, not least because Shevardnadze was failing to feed interests of all the groups that were grouped around him. And this produced primarily because of rampancy of corruption and informalization of politics. Let's say this state was increasingly failing to fulfill some of its basic functions, that is, you know, paying salaries to police, let's say, and things like that. And in the end, that was in 2001, he had dropped his whatever reformist agenda he had with attempt to shut down Rustavi II, which triggered spontaneous student demonstrations, and he had to sack government. And why 2001 was important? It showed that, as Lenin said, revolution is organization, organization, and organization. And that also applies to non-violent revolutions. And in 2001, we clearly saw that there was no organization. There were no structures that were necessary for a change of regime. And by that, I mean there were no structured political parties. The civil sector was out of politics and not focused on specific issues it had to be focused on. And there was no actor like Otpor. Just very briefly, how Kumara came around. The core of our movement, let's say, came together in 2001 when we started the first student government in Tbilisi State University, which is the largest university in Georgia. We campaigned against corruption in higher education because in post-Soviet Georgian reality, it happened so that higher education probably suffered the most because of rampancy of corruption, because of some connections of Shevardnadze with the bosses of the system. And after late 90s, the system increasingly failed to perform its ultimate function, that is to produce qualified graduates, and we are suffering greatly from that now because we are chronically short of qualified people on middle and lower levels. But the campaign was successful, it became evident that the reform in the sector, in higher education and in education in general, would be impossible without change of government. That coincided with this 2001 event when many things shaped up, and another group came around at that time, which was called Student Movement for Georgia, and this two groups came together to find Kumara. In foundation of which, very important, was an NGO called Liberty Institute in Tbilisi, which was important in providing international connections and also resources, because when we didn't have money, we used their offices as our own and, you know, all that type of stuff. There were several things which were key to our success. First was that Kumara was not a party. Georgia of that time was a typical post-Soviet society, and by that I mean that most of the public and particularly young people were a priori apathetic towards any kind of participation, even voting, because, you know, we can't change anything anyway. And they were particularly even antagonistic towards political parties as such, because being involved or being connected to a political party automatically equal to being driven by some, you know, rational interest that, you know, okay, they will go and you will come and continue the same. So Kumara emerged as a non-party actor and said, you know, we do not aspire power. Another thing about it was it had horizontal structure, which means that it didn't have a hierarchy. That had served two purposes. First was to, you know, keep motivation of activists very high. Of course, there were, in reality, 20 people ran Kumara, around 20 people, who had far greater weight than anybody else. But we still managed to maintain very, very, very high extent of motivation in all activists, and their number in the peak of the moment reached 3,000. And another purpose that the horizontal structure served was that if leaders were arrested, or if somebody was arrested, the organization could remain operational, and that proved extremely successful and correct in Najara, in the province of Georgia ruled by a pro-Russian dictatorial leader, Aslan Bashidze, who is not there anymore for more than a year, who resorted to massive repressions, and that proved really, really effective. So this horizontal structure promoted some kind of feeling of equality, even though, of course, as I said, there were more people who were more important than others. We did have a structure, but that was more kind of division of labor. We had several groups in which people were distributed in accordance with their skills and knowledge. So it was essential to success of the organization that everybody had to be busy with things that they knew better than others. One more key to success of Kumara was, let's say, some kind of cultivation of some kind of mythologization around the movement, and lots of bluffing. We resorted to lots of bluffing, particularly at early stage of our campaign. That means, for example, that while we maintained considerable distance from political parties and always sort of denied that we are youth branch of the national movement and things like that, for example, at an early stage, undercover political parties provided about 1,000 people for our rally, and for our first rally, and before then, only few people have heard about Kumara. So out of air, 1,000 people come out, and, you know, with Kumara t-shirts and Kumara flags, and, you know, it was like shocking. And we always try to use this shock therapy. For example, at that rally, we had the flags of Soviet Georgia with some pictures on it crossed, which meant that we rejected the past. And we approached the chancellery, and based on 2001 experience, they thought that we would stay there, but we threw these flags and we left. And the interior minister, who was later arrested, of course, was very surprised why we left so fast. And lastly, last factor about Kumara was intensive use of humor in its day-to-day activities, and that had particular specific connection with ordinary people. And we believed that by coming across or taking part in the Kumara actions that were humoristic, ordinary people who might never even had voted before, somehow, you know, when they came across it once, twice, three times, five times, they somehow received, developed some kind of feeling of participation in them. And on the last day, they came. And that's really true, because most part of the 120,000 people that appeared on the Freedom Square in November 22nd were not members of any party, any movement, or anything at all. Yeah. the opposition. For example, this is the previous slide. This is an example of such humor. We call this for a new Georgia bloc a bloc toilet, we said. And these are faces of, you know, Shevardnadze and all others, his entourage, and someone is flashing them. And we had many of these banners displayed, you know, in public places, in crowded places, and we offered those who just passed by to take a picture, and we gave them pictures. And we didn't even plan, but quite a number of activists was recruited through this kind of activity. So major approach of the opposition was to radicalize political space, to involve specific segments of the society into politics that were not, they were completely alienated from politics. The only instance when they sort of actively involved, and by these groups I primarily mean provincial populations, particularly from Samigrado, a region where the first president, Gamsa Khurdia, was ended very badly. So he made a great effort to involve those groups and to step into, as I mentioned already, politically protected areas. And there were two such areas. It was Autonomous Republic of Ajara and Kvemokartli. Kvemokartli is a province south of Tbilisi, populated mainly by ethnic Azeris. Since in Soviet times nobody cared about their integration into the Georgian society, they don't speak Georgian, they don't even know what country they live in, and as far as elections were concerned, their votes and number of votes was something like 400,000, which for Georgia is really a lot, was, you know, already granted for the government. And the same can be said about the Jara. While population there ethnically was Georgian, Mr. Abashidze, who had his own revival party, sort of, he had almost 100% vote. And on November 2 elections, for example, number of votes for that party exceeded overall population of that province, of course. So Mr. Saakashvili staged rallies in both of these provinces. He knew that this would trigger very serious violence, of course. And the people who were going there knew very well. We, undercover again, we made available 100 activists for him in Batumi. But these two particular events propelled his popularity in the immediate run-up to elections and positioned him as, let's say, the most fierce fighter with the regime. That produced some strains between him and Mr. Jrania and current chairperson of parliament, Nino Bourgeoisie, who were sort of more advocating more moderate approach. And they even had a slogan, which nobody remembers now, which said, revolutionary changes without a revolution. And but when eventually the movement began, that was forgotten. A couple words about the media. As I said, both Shevardnadze and Jrania Saakashvili supported development of free media as part of their political agendas, because they both viewed them as allies in their political game at different stages in history. Shevardnadze earlier, and Jrania and the former reformist group later. But as far as this specific station is concerned, it was always a commercial station. And Georgian advertising market is very small for sustainability of any commercial media outlet. So some other sources of funding were needed. And this meant that the channel's management all the time had to maneuver between various political actors to survive. And particularly after 2001, that was vital necessity, because there were numerous efforts to either to shut it down. There was one effort to shut it down, but there were numerous efforts to buy it out. particularly when Mr. Badri Patar Khatashvili, who previously was a tycoon in Russia, media tycoon, the founder of NTV, but when NTV was shut down, he sort of decided to return to Georgia. Particularly after he returned. Couple words about the civil society. As I said, in most of the let's say, literature, if we might call that literature, available, role of the civil society is greatly, or at least significantly, exaggerated. Why? Because, as I said, there were very, very few, maybe three NGOs that were important for the revolution. These were the Liberty Institute, as I said, and particularly the Election Monitoring Watchdog, International Society for Elections and Democracy, that produced parallel vote tabulation on election day. They deployed 3,000 volunteers on their own, and so that they had separate campaign. And we, for us, and for the opposition in general, sort of dichotomizing results that came out of that tabulation versus the official results was essential in mobilizing public support. But as I said, the overall sector remained largely elitist phenomenon, never managed to reach to the masses. It was composed of, as I said, English speakers who could write reports to foreign donors, and the programs that they were trying to fit in were designed for, most of them were designed for wider regions, you know, either post-Soviet, former Soviet Union, or Caucasus and Central Asia, etc., etc. And what I mean is that there was great extent of irrelevancy and even waste in many activities that these NGOs carried out. And lastly, opinion on the role of outsiders has varied from all kinds of conspiracy theories that it was nothing else but a coup staged by the CIA, or that there was no role at all. I think it is appropriate to divide Western support into two types, let's say. One type of support that, as I already mentioned, can be or is called sort of general long-term democracy promotion, and the support for the actual processes that led up to the revolution. As far as the second type of support is concerned, not only within we didn't have such support, but certain performance of certain officials, primarily I mean Ambassador Miles, who sometimes is portrayed as the ultimate orchestrator of the revolution, was messing things up, confusing things in the best case. I understand it had reasons similar to Georgian public. Our Western partners were also extremely concerned with Georgia's record, because when power changed in Georgia, it was always through violence. That in Caucasus, in history of the Caucasus, power never ever changed peacefully. And Georgia had very recent experience of very violent change of power in 1991 through civil war, and that was followed by two secessionist wars and another civil war. So why it was non-violent? There is no magic formula for that. On one hand, it was increasingly clear that Mr. Shevardnadze was becoming inadequate. His reactions to developments were inadequate. On another hand, there were various groupings around him, as I said, who had very significant disagreements. So there was no really centralized chain of command, in speaking in military terms, on our opponent's side. As far as security forces are concerned, of course there were negotiations with some of their leadership. Of course, there were hints or promises from certain parts of the military or the police that they wouldn't interfere. But of course, we were not sure. There were certain elite units which we did not know what they would do. So answer to this question is the term that is called critical mass. Critical mass for Georgia appeared that it was over 100,000 people, and doing anything against this dominant mass of people would equal to self-destruction. I am far from saying that those people who took part in these demonstrations were devoted pacifists. Everybody knew that something could happen, and we had people who were prepared for that. But it was a weapon of some sort. And of course, the essential part of the whole process was very explicit non-violent rhetoric and discipline of the structured actors of the process, and by that I mean Kamara and the political parties. About support of such groups, you know, there is opinion that we should have that in favor of various educational programs taking as many people as possible to exposing them to liberal values, to good educational training them in good educational institutions, etc., would inevitably sooner or later contribute to liberalization of the society, or those people will make it to the top, etc., etc. But the evidence is that that's not right. And by that, I look around Georgia, and Georgian case confirms that, Azeri case confirms that, and somewhat in in Armenia as well. Most of these people who are trained on those programs, let's say, scholarships, various programs, either go into business or simply decide to join the system, however strange might that sound. That is particularly evident in Azerbaijan. Why is that? I don't know. I don't have an answer to that question. But to my understanding, that's an empirical fact. Good part of Kumar's leadership was Western educated, including myself. I studied both in the United States and in London. But our involvement was not determined by that experience. We received some skills that were very useful to us, but we were already active. Or those extremely few numbers of people, Western educated people, who are active in the countries that I know, already were, politically involved before they were selected. I remember once I was invited to give a talk at there is this American Council for International Education, who have alumni club in Tbilisi, and their number is very significant, about 1,000. Its director was very sympathetic to Kumar and what we were doing, and he, even though he was not really allowed to do that, he invited me and my colleague Georgi Meladze to talk with these young people, because he thought that in one way or another they would be useful to us. And I think we tried really hard, but we encountered something we really didn't expect. It was complete unbelievable extent of nihilism and some kind of provincial snobism of those people. And I got myself interested in that question very much, and it appears that it's more or less the same in the neighboring countries, at least. In other countries, I don't know. I have not researched into that question.
Georgi, I'm going to stop you there, I think, because okay. We have a lot of speakers today, but thank you very much. And what I should be doing right now is turning to Sergei Taran, but he's not here yet. So instead, we'll turn to Corey Welt, who himself has written a paper about Georgia, a paper I didn't know about when we started this project. But it's a very good paper that he prepared for AID, USAID, and which I think you'll find out on the table outside. Corey, either there or up there, whichever you prefer.
Thank you. I think I'll be more comfortable here. Thank you very much for organizing the panel and for inviting me. I also apologize for coming in a few minutes late. Even though Daniel Sura mentioned the paper I had done, I don't want to spend time talking about the paper. What I do want to do is comment a bit on Georgi Kandelaki's very stimulating paper that he produced. I have to say that I've been awaiting a written product from him ever since the Rose Revolution. I've been very excited to hear, definitely, the activist, the participant's viewpoint of what occurred in the Rose Revolution. And part of what I felt was most intriguing and stimulating about what he's been working on is his own description of how Kvara actually functioned as an organization, and his absolute frankness in saying at the start that we weren't that powerful. Our mission was to try to convince the population and perhaps the authorities as well of our might. And I think that's a very interesting both insight and analytical admission, which is very, very useful. When I prepared my comments to address both the Georgian and the Ukraine case, and so this might be jumping ahead of things, but I wanted to raise the discussion a little bit out of the details of Georgia and talk a bit about analyzing comparative outcomes and trying to get a sense of, if we are trying to determine lessons learned from Georgia and Ukraine, well, what are the similarities of these cases? What are factors common to these cases in Kyrgyzstan, to bring in the third of the trio, that can be applied to other cases? And the broad question that I have simply is, is it important to ask this kind of question? Well, what factors are necessary for success? Are there certain factors that must be present in every case, or are cases just simply different? Ukraine is a different animal than Georgia. Kyrgyzstan is different than both. And certainly, if you look at both Ukraine and Georgia, you do see several similarities, which I don't need to go over in detail. Some of the factors are things that Georgi has mentioned: the combination of exit polls and parallel vote tabulation, the power of that sort of twin attack to demonstrate convincingly fraud. This mention of the importance of getting a critical mass of the population out on the streets before government forces crack down. Do you need 50,000, 60,000, without having the demonstration suppressed? And if you reach that point, then there's very little the government can do. How important — there's another factor which I believe, you know, Georgi mentions only briefly — but how important are past rounds of elections, democratic elections, quasi-democratic elections, but some kind of election that provides an institutional base for an opposition, which is sort of a first run that gives them an opportunity to develop a support base from within a political institution. So if you look at Georgia and Ukraine, you do see many common characteristics. However, if you stretch the discussion a little bit further and you look at Kyrgyzstan, a lot of what we've been working on very hard on Georgia and Ukraine somewhat falls apart. You realize that in Kyrgyzstan there wasn't a parallel vote tabulation as far as I've been led to believe. There also is a real question of how important a critical mass is. If in Kyrgyzstan you only had a scattered demonstrations, the developments evolved in a different sort of way. Well, then perhaps you don't need that many people to affect this kind of regime change. Past rounds of elections, you didn't have a similar situation in which you had opposition establishing themselves in some kind of institutional base. So Kyrgyzstan, on many different counts, looks very different from Georgia and Ukraine. And some of us might be inclined to say, well, Kyrgyzstan was much more dangerous. It could have gone wrong in a way that perhaps Georgia and Ukraine wouldn't have. And I'm not sure if this is just an explanation after the fact to deal with the fact that you have in Kyrgyzstan something that perhaps looks very different than in Georgia and Ukraine. If you do take one step even further back, though, I do think that there are some factors, which Georgi also does mention, which are common to these cases and which might be more useful to focus on. One being, of course, the split among the ruling elite. That is something that is present in all of the cases, that split happening at some point in the recent past. Some level of independent media, which has been discussed very thoroughly, and, of course, the unwillingness on the part of the government authorities to use force. That would seem to be very much a critical factor. I think it is very interesting to me to read in Georgi's comments that Shevardnadze himself at the end did decide to use force. It's something I do want to hear a little bit more about, because certainly the impression is throughout the entire period of time he was extremely reluctant, and the question really is at the end, even if he did pass an order, perhaps it was too late. But for the bulk of the period of time, he also was extremely reluctant to use force. So you have these categories, which all, of course, suggest, or these factors, which all are not necessarily separate factors, a split among the ruling elite, some independent media, an unwillingness to use force, all this points to some kind of, we can call it whatever we will, but a weakly authoritarian state, some state that isn't democratic but also isn't an Uzbekistan or isn't a Belarus. And how you define that state in advance, that can take some creativity, but I think it was very easy for observers of Georgian politics in advance, observers of Ukrainian politics in advance, perhaps, although Ukraine perhaps is somewhat different, but and observers of Kyrgyzstan in advance, to categorize this state as such and realizing that there might be an opening. Of course, it doesn't mean that you would then move to prediction just from identifying the kind of regime it is, but it certainly does seem that we do want to be careful being too hasty to put other kinds of regimes into the category of regimes that are vulnerable to this kind of political change. In terms of external assistance, I think it was very important how Georgian distinguishes between assistance, the kinds of long-range assistance that we do through AID and its various contractors, other Department of Justice, other kinds, other organizations, and diplomacy. But I think that the question still remains one that needs to be analyzed in much greater depth than we've done so far. Certainly there are things that were not as efficient or were not as productive from the part of the assistance providers, things that Georgi alludes to, but also there were many areas in which U.S. and other foreign assistance appear to have played some kind of role. They helped fund the exit polls and the PVTs. They were very involved in working out the election of the Central Election Commission, even though that commission, the composition wasn't the ideal one that the opposition might have wanted at the end. And they were involved. They had established networks with security forces, and they were sending messages near the end of the day that the security forces should think twice or more about using force. And so there are certainly areas in which at least U.S. assistance may have played a critical role. I'm not going to say that it did, but it's a question that needs to be asked, and we need to think a little bit more about how to make these connections between the kinds of U.S. assistance and U.S. diplomacy that were in place, the kinds of factors that we think were important for causing these political changes, and then determining whether there is a substantive link between the two, and whether certain things that happened that we might have played a role on the side, if those would have happened in any event, even without external assistance, would independent media have arisen that would have played a similar role to Rustavi in the absence of U.S. assistance? Certainly, the fact of the matter is that Rustavi, at the end of the day, was owned by a Georgian oligarch. It may have been started by U.S. Foreign assistance, or helped start by foreign assistance, but at the end of the day, it was a very native organization. And to sum up on these brief comments, I was trying to think again of the lessons learned for Georgia and Ukraine, and there's the one important lesson that I feel I'd like to communicate is just simply again to reiterate this idea of different kinds of states that are out there, and if we want to apply these kinds of lessons to a Belarus, to an Uzbekistan, to a Turkmenistan, even if we could even conceive of that, certainly we have to understand that we are playing with fire. That's fine if the population itself and those that might go out to demonstrate and to try to affect this kind of political change are aware of the danger that they're putting themselves in. Well, then that would certainly be an acceptable option for them. But I am afraid, particularly after the events that happened in Uzbekistan, which had nothing to do with an election, as we know, but still I'm afraid that there was certainly many signs of unwarranted optimism on the part of those on the square, particularly because of what happened with Kyrgyzstan, that they could do the same kind of thing, and they should have been more aware of the kind of the regime that they faced. I'm not trying to blame those; they're innocent victims. But we need to be careful not to have those kind of situations repeat themselves. So my sum up would simply be that we may have to recognize that this is a gradual process. That the trick, what we might want to do in terms of intervention, is try to think harder about how to crack the nut of these hardcore authoritarian regimes, and through a number of stages, get them to more resemble these weak authoritarian states, which is a very tricky thing to do. I'm not talking about engagement with the authoritarian states in order to democratize them. I'm talking about undermining them from within. It's questionable whether that's a policy that we want to pursue, and more whether or not we have the tools to do that sort of thing. But how can we start breaking up regimes from within? How can we encourage security forces to be reluctant about using force. These are the kind of questions that I think we need to be asking for cases in the future. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Corey. I want to call next on Alexander Goofman, who, after all, falls in the donor community, I think, and a lot of things have been said already about what works and what doesn't. Maybe we could hear from you about what works and what doesn't.
Great. Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. Wish I had gone before Corey, because he echoed a lot of what we wanted to say. First of all, I want to say that Freedom House has been looking at these regions for over 35 years through our Freedom of the World reports, Nations in Transit, Countries at a Crossroads. We've been examining very closely what the structures are, how they're changing, and how democracy has progressed or regressed in many of these countries. And I can say that I do not know of anyone at Freedom House that predicted any of these revolutions. In fact, many of us thought that they would never happen in the way and in the timing that they did. Therefore, it would be pretentious of me to sit here and say that we do have some of these answers, rather than suggesting, as Corey did, that we really do need much more rigorous research and a better analytical understanding of what happened and how these revolutions are similar, but more importantly, how they differ. I do want to mention one publication that we have released, which is How Freedom is Won. And the basic thesis of this publication is that the transition period provides a basic roadmap for where a country will go in the post-transition period. In that, levels of violence and the existence of violence during the transition period does affect the building of democratic institutions in the next year or 2 years. And I would urge any of you who have not seen this publication to see it and to look at it, because we are seeing some echoes of that in Ukraine and Georgia currently, and more importantly in Kyrgyzstan. I'm a senior program manager for Central Asia and Central Eastern Europe, so I'm taking a more comparative approach, as Corey did, looking beyond just Ukraine and Georgia, comparing it to the recent events in Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, also looking at Lebanon as well. And the one consistency that we've seen in research about those transitions, those developments, is an overemphasis, or at least an emphasis, on why security forces did not fire, rather than asking what I feel is an integral question, which is why the 100,000 did not fire. What held them back? And this is a question that we saw in Kyrgyzstan be answered to the negative, where you did have both violence as well as people storming government buildings. You did not see that to such an extent in Georgia and Ukraine. And one of the basic lessons we draw from that is the absolute importance of groups like PORA in Serbia, of OTPOR. In Ukraine, there was a highly organized civil society, local civil society infrastructure that were holding back some of the demonstrators. And we cannot overemphasize the importance of these local groups. Secondly, at least in Ukraine, official calls for restraint. Again, Yushchenko personally came out and called for discipline among the masses. And thirdly, the discipline that we've seen among the masses that have come about 100,000 to 300,000 at a time in the square in Ukraine, 100,000 in Georgia. So there's a very real question that I don't think we have answered yet, which is why the violence has not been more pervasive, such as what we saw in Andijan. Let's see, I do want to mention a little bit from the donor or program side concerning democracy and governance, because I think there is a misperception as to what democracy and governance programs do. As Corey mentioned, there is a two-prong approach, both long-term and short-term. And very often, the most successful programs are those that fly under the radar screen. And we hope they're flying under the radar screen, because I absolutely agree to Mr. Kandalaki that international groups are prone to taking too much credit, whether it's done on purpose or whether it's done through the media and the lack of a media response. The fact is, it's not the international community who are fomenting these transitions. They are local groups, often with the aid and with the support of others. But if you just take Ukraine as a case example, Russia invested a lot more money than the EU and the US combined. And if it was an international, if it was a geopolitical events that steered that election, I think we would have seen a very different response. Long term, there's no way to really measure the effect of exchanges. There's really no way to measure what long-term training can do for those involved in these groups. But we can still hope, and we do believe that these groups that have very minimal impact at the beginning of these transition periods, we see how they grow and evolve so that by the end they are organized. We have people in this room that have been involved in working with these groups during that transition period and have seen them flower into an existence that was pretty much incomprehensible while the beginning training periods were going on. One thing I do want to take issue with in terms of the general research and even some of the research presented here, which is the importance and the sole importance that is put on Election Day itself. Election Day provides a window of opportunity for nonviolent resistance. However, it minimizes the importance of the pre-election activity and the watchdogging activities that lead up to the general resentments, to the beliefs in liberal democracy, and to the eventual flashpoint that will mobilize 100,000 people to go out into the streets. And you remember in Ukraine, that was in the middle of winter. I was just talking to our staff 2 days ago that were in that square, just as personal citizens, and talking about coming home with, you know, blue feet and blue hands. I mean, it's an amazing testament to human courage and to the pre-election activities by local groups to present the information to independent media in some cases that documented and were able to give voice to some of the abuses and fraud that happened before Election Day. So I agree that we definitely need to support election missions. The most successful election missions have been those that were native. The Philippines is one of the best examples of that. But where you really see impact, again, are those groups that are able to develop and work in the pre-election environment. Let's see, I know we don't have much time, and I'd like to talk more about Ukraine, but given that there are other speakers, maybe I'll hold back on that and wait for the Q&A.
I'm going to turn next to Teres Cuzio, who has also written a paper for USAID about Ukraine, and he'll start us off in that direction.
Okay. Thank you for inviting me to an interesting comparative look at these colored revolutions. I think of the two papers, I prefer the Georgian to the Ukrainian in that it has more meat on its bones than the Ukrainian. I think that what I'd like to do in my short time is to add some meat to the Ukrainian paper, as it were, as bones. For one thing, there isn't really a mention of the fact that where Ukraine was slightly different was that there were two poras, not one. And as far as I understand, Sergei is linked to the yellow pora. The black pora followed the Georgian Kumara and Serbian Otpor in having a horizontal structure, whereas the yellow pora had a leader, Mr. Kaskiu, who was the leader of the pora political party. So there is a slight difference there. Let me look at sort of how Ukraine fits in following this comparative approach and then the Georgian case. There's actually even more than what's already been said in terms of how much there is similar in these colored revolutions. I would echo Corey in that all four states, Serbia, Georgia, Ukraine, Kyrgyzstan, were all semi-authoritarian, or what the political scientist Lucan Way calls competitive authoritarian states. That's not a coincidence. So therefore, that begs the question, I wonder whether you can have a nonviolent revolution in an authoritarian state. Look at China, Tiananmen Square, for example, which was a nonviolent protest. And of course, we know the case of Uzbekistan recently. The other factor which is similar is that there was a deep political crisis preceding the elections. And this goes back to the question that you raised, really, the question of a testing case. I forget who actually raised it. It's been so much said today. The testing case, as it were. Without Kuchma Gate in Ukraine, there wouldn't be Orange Revolution. The murder of Hrori Gungadze, the journalist, in the fall of 2000, led to the collapse of the regime's authority in Ukraine to an unprecedented level. It led to the election of Viktor Yushchenko's political party as the lead party in the 2002 elections, where the Ukrainian parliament had half of its members were in the opposition to the current regime. And of course it led to Yushchenko's election as president 2 years after that. I don't think that's... And the other factor which is important for the from the point of view of the preceding case, it's as a poor activist said to me in an interview last year, that the Kuchmagate crisis was our 1905 and Orange Revolution was our 1917. We failed in 1905 to remove Kuchma, but we learned the lessons. And one of the big lessons was non-violence. How the Kuchmagate protests collapsed in March of 2001 was precisely because the authorities had infiltrated extreme right-wing nationalists into the crowds, and these instigated violence, and the authorities used that as an excuse to denounce the entire opposition. And the protests just completely fizzled out. And that was something that hasn't really been noted in the Ukrainian case. Also, the importance of the united opposition in all of these, Georgia, Ukraine, and, of course, Serbia. The opposition in that part of the world, as we've seen in Ukraine the last month or so, are notoriously fickle, big egos, and have difficulty in coming together. Young people are important in forcing those leaders to come together and unite on one platform, and that is extremely important. Just a sort of amusing side to this, if you compare Georgia and Ukraine, is that if you compare Saakashvili Burjanezi in the Ukrainian case, then probably Saakashvili is Tymoshenko,
yes,
and Burjanezi is Yushchenko. I think the Georgians got it the right way around in terms of president, prime minister. Ukrainians got it the wrong way around, I think. Yushchenko would have been a good prime minister, not necessarily president, but anyway. But also what's interesting is the mistakes that the authorities make. Milosevic made that mistake in Serbia and in Georgia and in Ukraine. In Ukraine, one of the biggest mistakes was the choice of the candidate. You talk a lot in your paper, for example, about Ajaria. Well, think of a situation where Shevardnadze had chosen Abashidze as his successor candidate. That was the equivalent of choosing Yanukovych. Donetsk was a country within a country in Ukraine. It was as a region of Ukraine allowed to do what it wanted to do under Kuchma. It was a region which had this very close nexus between organized crime, law enforcement, politics, and business. So in other words, Ajaria. I think there's a very, very close parallel there. Big mistake. The choice of Yanukovych as candidate was a great boon for the opposition in Ukraine. Radicalization of young people, in particular, I think is very important. The move from a politically apathetic young people to a radical. And remember that what's, I think, crucial here, which kind of comes in, is that these are young people born in the 80s. They're born when Gorbachev comes to power. They don't know the Soviet communist system. They grew up in the 1990s. If you're 20 today in the Orange or Georgian Revolution, you were born when Gorbachev came to power in the mid-80s. And so you have a very different mindset to people older than you. Also, some...
George is commenting that he was born when Brezhnev died.
So. Okay. Well, he's slightly older. You have the benefits of experiencing the era of stagnation. And then, also, I think what's important is getting those numbers on the streets, which is impossible to predict in advance. And you can... In the Ukrainian case, they could believe that you could get 80,000 on the streets, 100,000 maybe, who would be the hardcore activists from Kiev and Western Ukraine. But you needed more than that, at least in the Ukrainian case.
Definitely.
And that's where you have, and it's very difficult to pinpoint, and I think especially if you're making a film on it, extremely difficult to pinpoint the change in mood during the election cycle. Because Ukrainian election began in July. During most of that election period, the commonly held view was, yes, Yushchenko will win, but the authorities will rig the vote, and therefore Yanukovych will be declared candidate. But sometime in late October, November, that mood changes to one that we can win, we can do it. And the big mistake, another mistake the authorities made, therefore, is after a 10-day deadline passes, to declare Yushchenko the victor in round one. Even though it's only 0.5%, that changed the view of the population that Yushchenko would actually do it. And the mood just changes in those 3 weeks between round one and round two. And the more you have people coming on the streets, the more they're not touched by the authorities in terms of repression, that encourages more and more to come. And you have a kind of a roller coaster effect throughout that week. And in particular, I think the decisive moment is on the Wednesday, 3 days into the revolution, when the authorities declare Yanukovych elected. Colin Powell, who I think is a hero at the time, says the US refuses to recognize the results. The European Union typically follows America's lead, although it doesn't like to say it does, follows American lead. And then all of those other people who are sitting on the sidelines, sitting sort of waiting, wavering, the Leonid Kravchuk types, like in August 1991, wait to see how the coup goes in Moscow, see which way you should jump. All of those jump into the Orange Revolution. And then after, from Thursday onwards, I think it's a done deal. Humor, you mentioned humor, and that is, I think, a key thing in Serbia, Georgia, and Ukraine. And where it's important is in how humor is used to ridicule the authorities. You no longer fear the authorities, you laugh at them. I mean, one of my favorites is where the Khreshchatyk, the central street of Kiev, on a Saturday and Sunday is closed to traffic, and Porab and young students would dress up as prisoners released from prison for the weekend, and they would go up and down the Khreshchatyk chanting, Yanukovych, Yanukovych. Why? Because Yanukovych was twice in prison as a young man. So the image was set that young people were released from prison to campaign for Yanukovych, one of their own. And this kind of humor was very good. Just look at eggs.net.ua and you'll see what I'm talking about. Media and communications. The Ukraine revolution has been talked about as maybe the first internet revolution. Here again, the importance of a semi-authoritarian regime, still permitting some examples of media freedom. In the Ukrainian equivalent of Rostavi would be Channel 5 and ERA TV. And the wide use of modern communications for a variety of things. One of the strangest examples of this, just to give you a very strange example, is how cell phones, which can video, were used by students to video their professors calling upon students to vote for Yanukovych, which is illegal. So they'd put the cell phone like that, and they'd be videoing this dumb professor who's illegally agitating the students for that. I mean, so that they were able to use modern communications, modern techniques, modern election tactics in a very different way to the very neo-Soviet approach of Yanukovych and Kuchma. Just briefly on the security forces. I think that certainly one thing that unites Serbia, Georgia, Ukraine, I know we're talking only about Georgia, Ukraine today, but it certainly unites all three, is that the security forces either stay neutral or defect. And I have a paper outside which looks at why the Ukraine revolution was nonviolent and the role of the security forces here. I think in all three cases, you have secret contacts between the opposition and the law enforcement. Certainly in the Ukrainian case, the military and the security service were pretty much pro-Yushchenko. For many of them in the officer corps, the idea that you could have an ex-con as their commander-in-chief was just anathema. I mean, you might not think that's important, but that's important if you are an officer with some honor. Because you can't become a police officer if you're an ex-con, but you can become a president. But bringing in the Western angle, which I'll finish on, the role of the international community, here, an angle which hasn't been looked at, and probably very difficult to pinpoint, is the role of things like NATO and NATO's Partnership for Peace, and the role of bilateral security cooperation, what's called in the spirit of PFP, between the US, Britain, and Ukraine in particular. Ukraine was always the most active CIS country since January 1994, when PFP was created, in working with NATO and bilaterally with the US and Britain. And that changed very much the culture of the officer corps in the country. making them very different, for example, to the Russian officer corps. In the Ukrainian case, the most dangerous time was on the Sunday, exactly a week after round two, when Kuchma was finally persuaded by Yanukovych to send in internal troops against the Orange Revolution. They were stopped by two things. Taxi drivers blocked the roads, and secondly, the armed forces intervened to say, we will defend the Orange Revolution. And why else would they do that? I mean, I think that's... On international support, briefly, Ukraine is different, I think, from both, certainly Serbia, but certainly, I think, Georgia, in that PURA was not financed by the West, by the U.S. There's no evidence of PURA being financed by any U.S. organization. Freedom House supported the Coalition for Free Elections, within which Yellow PURA is based. But there's no direct funding from the U.S. to PURA. The U.S. stayed very aloof and was actually, I've been told, scared of even getting involved with PURA. One reason being was the timing of the elections. The American elections were 3 days after the Ukrainian first round, and Ukraine had the fourth largest military contingent in Iraq, which Kuchma obviously put there, not because he was so pro-American, which is certainly not the case, but because he wanted a pass from the Bush administration on election fraud. The Ukrainian revolution is different, I think, from Georgia and both Serbia, because you had a stable, you didn't have a failed state, you had a strong, robust economy. Ukraine's economic growth last year was the highest in Europe. And therefore, most of the funds for the Orange Revolution came from domestic sources, not from foreign sources. The USA, I would say US policy, I have to be careful, is at least one State Department official here, was I think pretty standoffish until round one, one reason being the timing of the US elections. But from round one to round two, and of course after round two, the US played a very key role, and I mentioned Colin Powell. As for the European Union, I'm from Britain, so you should know my view of the European Union. But just read the footnote 51 in Mr. Kindelaki's paper, which refers to something I've suspected all along and is actually, I think, actually very true. That if it hadn't been for the fact that last year, Central Europe, former communist state Central Europe, joined the European Union.
The difference was that the European Union was enlarged.
Yes,
when Ukraine
the European Union was enlarged last year just on the eve of the Ukrainian elections, as was NATO for the second round. The European Union was enlarged. It brought in seven or eight post-communist states. These were the ones, particularly the Polish and Lithuanian presidents, who lobbied Brussels, which was very standoffish and disinterested in getting involved in the Ukrainian Orange Revolution, to bring Solana from Brussels into Kiev. The main reason being is for the simple reason that, as Donald Rumsfeld calls old Europe, didn't want to offend Russia. The old problem, and probably because the European Union still has a problem in getting its foreign policy act together. But certainly that was because of, we can thank Lithuania and Poland on that. One final thing on in his paper, Mr. Taran's paper, conspiracy theory. Conspiracy theories are very common in post-Soviet states, too common. He talks a bit in his paper about how Kuchma never intended Yanukovych to win, that this was all a big game, and that he deliberately chose such a bad candidate so that the elections would be declared annulled, and that Kuchma or somebody else closer to Kuchma, like maybe the head of the presidential administration, Viktor Medvedchuk, could come in the year after. I'm suspicious about this. There's no real evidence of this, although these kind of rumors circulated at the time. On that, I'll leave it and maybe open.
Thank you very much, Taras. I'm going to turn to Annika Binnendijk, who it shouldn't be said that we only have young activists who speak at the Institute, but also young scholars. And Annika has been interviewing people in Ukraine last summer, and in particular focused on this question of the security forces and why they behaved the way they did. So I'm looking forward to hearing her remarks. Annika?
So the other panelists have covered some of the broader questions on why the recent popular movements in Georgia and Ukraine were successful and what challenges they faced. I'm going to go into a bit more detail on one of the challenges that Dr. Kuzio had touched on, which is the issue of the national security forces. My research focused on the Orange Revolution is asked the following question. How did actions taken by the opposition movement affect the perspectives of individuals and the Ukrainian security forces? These include the military, the interior ministry, troops and police, and the SBU, the successor organization to the KGB. Is this working? Although President Kuchma had publicly renounced violence from the beginning of the standoff, there were those in his camp who were pressing for a crackdown should the right circumstances present themselves. So the task of the movement was to make sure that these circumstances didn't prevail. Last summer, with support from the International Center on Nonviolent Conflict and the Fletcher School, I took a research trip to Kiev. I interviewed leading members of the Our Ukraine and Pora organizations, officers in the Interior Ministry, military, and SBU, diplomats, journalists, and scholars. In each conversation, I asked whether any steps taken by members of the opposition movement might have seemed significant in influencing attitudes within the Ukrainian security forces. My findings fell into four categories: safety in numbers, disciplined organization, effective use of strategic communication, and networking within the security forces. First, safety in numbers. The large number of Ukrainians at the Maidan is widely acknowledged as one of the reasons the revolution was successful. The masses that the opposition was able to generate elevated the movement's national significance and legitimacy for many within the security forces. The strong start to the protests also caught the authorities by surprise. Although Yushchenko, too, was surprised by the eventual turnout, it was not accidental. Members of the Ukrainian public had been mobilized over the months preceding the elections through rallies and events at the regional level. Coordinators realized that the participation of Kiev's population would be crucial and focused particular attention on that city. Once the Maidan protests had begun in earnest, the movement leadership maintained crowd interest through the high-level speakers, concerts, and frequent announcements about the importance of sustaining a critical mass. For the security forces, the enormous crowds heightened the dilemma. On the one hand, they made clearing the square physically difficult. Any action could lead to large-scale panic and bloodshed. This, of course, considerably raised the stakes involved in issuing or obeying an order to crack down. The fact that many Kiev-based officers had family and friends in the crowd undoubtedly weighed in as well. On the other hand, police and interior ministry troops knew that they were responsible for public safety and would be held accountable if chaos broke out. So the risks of both action and inaction seemed considerable. Because of this dilemma, large crowds alone weren't enough. The crowd needed to act with discipline to dispel the apparent risk of chaos or violence. This brings me to my second point, disciplined organization. A strong commitment to nonviolent methods and training months in advance allowed the movement to avoid altercations between protesters and police or between Yushchenko and Yanukovych supporters. As Alexander mentioned, this highlighted the importance of a well-trained cadre to guide and organize the crowd. Pora and Our Ukraine volunteers formed human buffer zones between police and crowds. Trained volunteers patrolled the tent camps and crowds, looking for and diffusing potential disturbances. Pamphlets were distributed saying, "Remain unprovoked. We will win. We are strong because we are calm." All of this seems to have had an impact on the police and military. One senior law enforcement official said to me in June, "I have a great deal of respect for the fact that the Yushchenko team did all it could to prevent any kind of conflict. They did not look very aggressive. It was amazing." The strategic calculation to remain nonviolent was deliberate. A Pora coordinator put it this way: "If we were not violent, we could compete. If we were violent, they would have resorted to force. Nonviolent methods put us on equal terms with the state authorities. This was the only effective strategy within that environment." Self-restraint also mattered. As days passed and the protests continued, pressures rose from the crowd and within the leadership to storm the presidential administration building, which was surrounded by heavily armed special forces. Fortunately, Yushchenko's restraining voice prevailed, and this red line was not crossed. So that leads me to my next topic, strategic communications. Before and during the Orange Revolution, movement leaders sent several clear messages to the security forces. The first message was, "We are nonviolent. We are not a threat to public safety." The second message was, you will be accountable if you order or participate in a crackdown. The third was, you have a stake in our vision of Ukraine's future. Not only was it important that protesters were disciplined, but it was crucial that they effectively communicated this to security forces. Through public announcements and private assurances, Our Ukraine, PORA, and other participants consistently reinforced this message. In discussions with security officers and political leadership, opposition leaders also emphasized that individuals would be held personally accountable if violent suppression occurred. Following orders would be no excuse. Allies in the security forces and the Western diplomatic community also helped to drive home this message. One tangible check that security forces knew about was a 24-hour live television feed from the Maidan, open to media sources. As one observer told me, the message here was, if you're going to make us bleed, it'll be live on CNN. Yushchenko was also careful to send positive signals to the security forces. In public and private messages, he appealed to them, saying, we're building a new Ukraine. The country needs your honesty, your experience, and your professionalism. In doing so, he offered them an alternative to blind obedience of the regime's commands. But how are all of these private messages conveyed? My last finding was the significance of opposition networking within the security forces. An Our Ukraine military project began in early 2003 when the retired chief of the Ukrainian Air Force, General Volodymyr Antonets, joined the team's ranks. General Antonets was charged with developing a political strategy to reach out to voters in the security forces. The high esteem with which he was held by active duty officers helped make his networking efforts a success. General Antonets began by establishing regional centers throughout Ukraine. Each was made up of 5 retired military officers, one focusing on interior troops, a second for the Army, another for the Ministry of Emergencies, and the fourth for border troops, and the fifth to supervise. One major goal was to get a feel for prevailing opinions within the ranks. The teams initiated discussions with the family members of troops, who, as General Antonets told me, can serve as good barometers. The teams also tapped into Ukraine's large population of military veterans by organizing councils to discuss retirement benefits and other issues. These provided additional opportunities to test out the political waters. Some of these veterans would later be recruited by General Antonets to help maintain security on the Maidan. The regional teams were also actively campaigning for Yushchenko. During one initiative, parents of soldiers wrote letters in support of Yushchenko, which were then distributed to troops in garrison's towns. In another, young women were organized to deliver flowers to junior-level officers to celebrate military holidays. Particular attention was paid to police and military academies. This proved to be a successful strategy. By the end of the first week of protests, hundreds of Interior Ministry cadets had joined the civilians on the Maidan in full uniform. At the more senior level, Our Ukraine members of parliament were in contact with generals in the military, Interior Ministry, and the SBU, many of whom they had known socially or professionally. Conversations with officers throughout the Ukrainian army were especially fruitful. The number one goal of General Antonets' team in contacting military officers was to convince them not to allow Kuchma to use the army to break up protests. They were extremely successful in this. In fact, the army was ultimately so supportive of the protesters that his chief of staff even threatened to put unarmed soldiers between protesters and oncoming interior ministry troops, such a scenario occur. SBU contacts, whose positions were somewhat more ambiguous, nonetheless provided vital information on the night of November 28th, when interior troops surrounding Kiev began to mobilize. The cell phones of the Our Ukraine staff were ringing within minutes. And although allies were few and far between in the Interior Ministry Officer Corps, the Our Ukraine headquarters even received a few calls that night from individuals stationed outside the city to inform them of the mobilization and to say that they would not obey orders to march to Kiev. With information of mobilization, the Our Ukraine staff was able to alert Western embassies, media sources, and allies within the security forces. The Interior Ministry leadership was soon bombarded with calls from the Chief of Staff of the Ukrainian Army, the head of military counterintelligence, and several Western diplomats. Investments in networking thus paid off. Connections on the inside of security institutions allowed the opposition movement both to gain access to information and to react quickly to it. So what are the lessons we can learn from the Orange Revolution about the relationship between an opposition movement and security forces? Although each case is obviously unique, and there's no one blueprint for success, a few broad conclusions might be drawn. The first is that the large numbers that the opposition movement was able to quickly attract and sustain generated potential power and legitimacy in advancing their goals. but simply bringing the masses to the streets would not have been sufficient. It even could have been counterproductive had the process not been effectively managed. In Ukraine, the opposition movement's relationship with the security forces was founded on mutually reinforcing elements that each flowed from the potential power that the large crowds afforded them. First, with a sound concept of strategic communications, the opposition teams targeted the security forces with key messages. These messages minimized perceived threats to public safety, reinforced accountability, and offered them a stake in their vision for the nation's future. Next, the message of pacific intent was reinforced by the restrained behavior of the crowd, which demonstrated in the streets that the application of popular will can be at once both forceful and nonviolent. Finally, networking behind the scenes had opened channels of communication and pinpointed allies within the security forces that would prove critical when violence seemed imminent. With these factors in place, leaders of the Orange Revolution were thus able to alter the decision-making environment for those in uniform, and thus able to undermine the government's capacity for violent action.
Thank you very much, Annika. That was a very interesting inside view of the situation. I'm told Sergei is going to arrive within the next few minutes, but I'd like to open the floor for discussion. In any case, we have a microphone that we have to use, I think, because of the cameras, so I'll ask people to go up there. I confess that I've now read a number of papers on this subject. I was involved one way or another in Serbia. I think if there's one lesson that I draw from all of this, if I were a semi-autocrat trying to avoid this from happening to me, I would make very, very sure that no one could count the votes except me. That would be my really critical conclusion. Of course, I would have a strong security force. It would be unified. I wouldn't fight with those in my circle. I would avoid a lot of the problems that have been mentioned. I'd pick a good candidate for whatever election it was. A lot of things that I would do. But the one really vital thing is that I would make absolutely sure that nobody but me could count the votes. And that, it seems to me, is an interesting lesson. I'm sure it's been drawn. I'm sure it's been drawn in a number of places.
In Central Asia especially.
If I were in the U.S. government deciding where some of our assistance goes, I confess that I would be targeting, I know the name of the group best in Serbia, CESID, which was the organization that knew how to count. And in politics, counting votes is really important. The floor is open to others to make comments. Please.
Diana Aldis, and I'm with Public International Law and Policy Group, and I want to thank all of you for coming.
Could you speak right into the microphone?
I'd like to thank you for coming, and I thought you had a lot of interesting things to say, and I was wondering what your thoughts were about Kazakhstan with the elections coming up there. You've all mentioned Uzbekistan and even Turkmenistan, and there's been a recent crackdown there with the media, and Nazarbayev's been pretty successful in cracking down on the opposition there, and I was wondering if you had any thoughts about that situation.
Georgi's had one of his vacations in Kazakhstan recently, so we'll ask him to respond. His last vacation in Belarus ended with a free stay, right?
No, I had to pay.
Well, you had to pay. Yeah.
Okay. No, everybody who is in that jail pays something at their day.
Yeah. But in breakfast, right?
I have a receipt. Yeah.
You can't make any assumptions in this world. He had to pay for his stay in prison in Belarus.
Lukashenko, but in breakfast.
Kazakhstan.
Yes, well, I was there in June 2004, and everything you said is right and continues to a greater extent. The political party that I was visiting has been banned, the Democratic Choice of Kazakhstan, and certainly, the polls are getting screwed in Kazakhstan. And just today, I've been looking into Washington Post, and there were some statements made by Condoleezza Rice, and this is of course my personal opinion, and she called Mr. Nazarbayev a reformer, both in economic and also political realm and all that. And I think at least it is more responsibility of democratic countries not to make statements like that.
Thank you.
Others? Jack Duval, who I'll give him a little advertising here. Jack runs the International Center for Nonviolent Conflict and is a stalwart of this subject.
I'd just like to make two brief comments, if I might, and then invite any reaction from anyone who would care to respond. It seems to me that the great success of nonviolent resistance in Georgia and Ukraine, and earlier in Serbia, and then the following success in expelling the Syrians from Lebanon of the so-called Cedar Revolution, has tended to make us think that this phenomenon started in the 21st century, when in fact we have some 40 or 50 years and 20 or 25 major nonviolent struggles which have been differentially successful to consider in terms of examining the observable similarities between these nonviolent revolutions and how they unfold. In fact, the Freedom House study that Alexander talked about looked at 67 transitions from authoritarianism to democracy in the last 35 years and found that in 50 of those cases there was active nonviolent civic resistance which played a critical role. And when one does look at all of those cases, one tends to find that there isn't, in fact, a rigid correlation between the apparent capacity of a regime to use repressive violence and the outcome driven by a nonviolent civic resistance, because there really aren't any useful static conditions or predisposing conditions to look at, because the process of these conflicts is highly iterative, interactive, and dynamic. And what the movements do, what these nonviolent civic coalitions actually do proactively, change conditions actively as the conflict unfolds. If you were a black in a township in South Africa in the 1980s, you were living under a repressive state. If you were underground with Solidarity in the early 1980s, you were living under a repressive state. But in each case, the strategic use of nonviolent tactics changed the dynamic equation sufficiently over the course of a series of 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 years that ultimately there was success by what's called people power. So my only suggestion would be that we look at the full basket of cases historically, and that as we do so, we look at what movements do to change conditions as these conflicts unfold so that we can really harvest the best lessons.
Thank you, Jack. I think that's an excellent reminder that things are not written in stone and that conditions can be made to change. Please.
Hello, I'm Emil Sanamian from Armenian Assembly. Question for Georgia experts here. We try to discuss on the academic side more of a sort of try to find a scholarly general approach to the situations. I'm more interested in sort of the rumor mill, the kind of popular attitude that existed in Georgia, say. Specifically, Georgi, in your very candid presentation, you mentioned that you've been bluffing quite a bit early on in your efforts. Were you trying to present yourself as American agents or as someone linked to America? Was that good for your image? And in general, how did those factors of conspiracy, a larger conspiracy, some of them included our organization in that conspiracy in Georgia, play in? Was that generally a negative thing? You try to distance yourself from that, or by embracing or hinting at links somewhere abroad, you were able to sway, say, a security apparatus or sway certain apolitical, apathetic mass that there was? And maybe Corey could comment generally on that conspiracy theory-mindedness in Georgia.
Well, thank you. By bluffing, I primarily meant that we were bluffing, aiming to present ourselves as more powerful, and I didn't keep in mind the conspiracy theories. And that's a very interesting question because, you know, in the Georgian society, everyone, all political actors of that time were on the, let's say, statements level pro-Western and therefore pro-American, including the government. So the, what could be brought forth was that, and what a spokesperson for New Georgia Bloc, which was the name of Mr. Shevardnadze's bloc at the time, said, so the blame, only blame that could be found that we are Russian agents, in fact. So they said that you are agents of Russia, Russian special services. And that was, you know, very, very easy to rebuff, and we succeeded to sort of shut them up on that when basically in the end when the Western partners, particularly Americans, were increasingly getting disillusioned in Shevardnadze. Shevardnadze was scared on that, so he was a little uncertain in how they would react to his definite decision to rig the vote, I think, but he, though I think he was exaggerating that fear, but that's another talk. He started giving many things up to Russians, and one of those things was the whole of the energy sector. One day we woke up and we heard that, you know, all of it is sold to Russians, and we had one of the big demonstrations at that day. Another good example of bluffing was that when Mr. Chubais arrived in Tbilisi airport, so we had a variety of actions going on in the city, but just seven people, including myself, went to the airport to meet Mr. Chubais. And by the time, and that was in August 2003, Kumara had such a mythological, crazy image that they decided to take Mr. Chubais out from some secret exit. And but there were just seven kids there. And in one interview I read a couple days later in Izvestia, I think, Mr. Chubais said that he was met by crowds of angry students in the airport. But we were just seven people.
He was probably disappointed. please.
My name is Yoav Kahane. I have studied nonviolent transitions in the Caucasus elsewhere for USIP, among others, and I confess to having a slight concern coupled with great admiration, and that is about, forgive me, I'm using the terms tentatively, near smugness or self-congratulatory tone, unreserved self-congratulatory tone, not only about this forum, but generally insofar as the discussion of nonviolent revolutions is concerned, which is that I think we have to recognize that the success, remarkable success, of street politics has planted dangerous seeds in the minds of various political cultures, particularly ones that have had little exposure to democracy and do not value the virtues of tolerance. Georgia is one. Probably an outstanding example of a political culture bereft of those virtues. I felt uncomfortable hearing those smug allusions to the science of revolution. I know you're not a Leninist, but you have invoked one of the greatest totalitarians of the 20th century with almost euphoric enthusiasm. Revolution is organization, bluffing your way into power, and so on. We know that during the Ukrainian Revolution, Yulia Tymoshenko had a completely different order of legitimacy in mind. She wanted to overthrow the system. She wanted to have the mobs invade parliament and do exactly what was done in Tbilisi. And mind you, if we check transitions in various countries, perhaps starting with the Velvet Revolution, it was so easy in late 1989 to overthrow Husak, take him out of the palace, out of the castle. And yet he was used in order to smoothen the transition. And so much can be said in favor of using existing vehicles. For example, perhaps as an afterthought, might it not have been better I'm not saying it would have necessarily been possible. It might not even might it not have been better to allow Shevardnadze to complete his constitutional term as president and use him the way the revolutionaries in Prague used Husak to legitimize the new order, rather than planting or reaffirming perceived notions that certainly are prevalent in Georgia about the likelihood and the desirability of violent overthrows of governments. Is there any way to change power in Georgia other than by violence? Is there any way of affirming a popular democratic leader other than by near unanimity, the one that Gamsakhurdia received 90% or so in perfectly democratic elections in 1991, the one that, or nearly won, that Shevardnadze won in his first election as president, and now the present incumbent? These are all, I'm not saying it remotely in order to call into question the desirability of those revolutionary acts, or in any way to reserve my congratulation for their success. Just by way of suggesting that one should give more thought to how to educate the next generation of the residents or denizens of those newly created democracies in the virtues of not turning to the street again, a temptation that might well be irresistible.
This is a very interesting question, and one I think we should delve into in some depth. I feel Georgie here wants to say something, Corey as well, and Alexander.
A very short answer, perhaps, but answer can be very long as well. I think part of the answer to that question has been given by President Saakashvili in his not-so-old article in Financial Times, when he said that the revolution will end or to win finally when he is out, voted out from the office. And that will happen sooner or later, that the government will change through elections in Georgia sooner or later. So, and regarding Shevardnadze, that was not possible. With full appreciation, it's extremely impossible scenario that was.
Corey?
Sure. First, I'll take it upon myself to defend the honor of Georgie and his people to say that the Georgian political culture is more tolerant than you've made it out to be, and it's hard. And these do change over time, and what happened, what was represented in the Gamsakhurdia is not the same that's under Saakashvili. And anybody who follows the politics closely today understands that there are distinctions no matter what the faults are of the current regime, of which we could discuss them. The point I wanted to address, though, is that, you know, what you said is it possible, you said, is it possible for there to for a change in regime to take place in Georgia without violence? I know you meant without these kind of events that took place, which were largely nonviolent, but nonetheless, you would still say in this process itself, I very much appreciate the comments about the iterative nature of the process that were made before, because in this process itself, there were opportunities for the government to change change the course of developments. There was an effort, even though you have perhaps Georgi representing the quote-unquote revolutionary mentality, you had a very much efforts on the part of the political parties to negotiate with the government, and there were options and there were efforts made to try to get them to produce a different outcome. And in terms,
sorry to interrupt, yep, you very much, but the initial demand was recognition of fair results of parliamentary election. The initial demand up until almost middle of the 20-day protest was not resignation of Shevardnadze.
And even more, there would be, I would say, a willingness to horse trade on the part of the parties that ultimately won. I mean, we don't have to say that this is entirely clean, but one, something that goes back to what Taras was talking about with the mistakes of the regime, that Shevardnadze probably could have gotten away with this kind of quasi-democratic outcome. Everybody would have accepted it.
Absolutely.
If not for Ajara and Abashidze's role. And once he ended up relying, the mistake on the outside world's part was not seeing that this was coming. It was very obvious it was coming. But within the system, if he had not relied so heavily on it, then the elections would have been somewhat fraudulent, but then the opposition would not have been able to get these people out in the street. It was this really anger, this indignation about relying on such an illegitimate portion of the political elite to retain power. So, yes, there were other options, but at some point in time, I mean, it's either put up and shut up, or try to make a difference, and that's what they were trying to do.
Alexander,
a note of caution is well taken, and I want to twist it a little bit because there are other forums where the lesson learned are being spoken about in Central Asia, and the conclusions are entirely different. And the governments are listening to those lessons learned. And I can tell you Freedom House has felt the direct impact of the what we call here the successes in Georgia, Ukraine, and Kyrgyzstan. And we should be aware that life for human rights defenders, for democratic liberals in Central Asia and elsewhere have suddenly become much more difficult as a result of these revolutions.
Yes, please.
I take very much your point about the smoothness of the transition, you mentioned the Velvet Revolution. The Ukrainian case is probably a better example of that with the roundtable negotiations, even though the European Union had to be dragged kicking and screaming to them. But Yushchenko had a choice. He either had to follow Tymoshenko and storm the presidential administration with potential for violence because the riot police around the presidential administration were deliberately brought from the Crimea, and they would have had no hesitation in shooting Ukrainian nationalists, quote-unquote, the ones who were mistaken for being Russians in Ukrainian uniforms, and or doing the roundtable negotiations. There were the two choices. And Yushchenko went for the roundtable, Tymoshenko wanted to storm. Now, the roundtable didn't produce bloodshed. But at the same time, one lingering effect which is had to this day, which is probably negative, is the issue of giving Kuchma immunity from prosecution. A lot of us are suspicious, and I think that suspicion has now been probably proven, that at those roundtable negotiations, particularly with the support of Kwasniewski, President of Poland, and Solana from the EU, that Yushchenko agreed to some kind of immunity for Kuchma. And that has stalled the entire investigation of this year into the murder of Yuri Gungadze, where you have three policemen who were present when he was killed on trial this month, but the actual ones who ordered the killing, Kuchma and his other staff, were obtaining immunity. I'm not sure that's a good outcome either, especially because just last week the Council of Europe and demanded that Ukraine move ahead on this whole process. I mean, I take your point, but it's a very difficult balancing act.
I think that's right. I could cite the Serbian example as well, where the preservation of the security forces intact has been a real drawback for the years since I wouldn't even call it a revolution there. It was simply recognition of election results under the Constitution. Eric?
Yes, I wanted to echo, but with distinction, some of the hesitance in making all of these comparisons of the different revolutions. We've been involved with the Institute for Democracy in Eastern Europe, starting in Poland in 1980 and up until Kyrgyzstan in 2005. And what we would argue is that there is not a single instance of comparable revolution. You may have common elements, you may have common characteristics, but there are no common characteristics that determine whether one country or another country can have a revolution. And I think it's very important to beware making these types of comparative analysis. You know, Serbia affected Georgia, clearly. We know the interactions that took place, and we were helpful in making some of those interactions take place. But Serbia was influenced by Slovakia and by Poland. Mm-hmm. And Belarus is being influenced by many places. And if we have certain characteristics, let's say a semi-authoritarian regime, should we simply give up on Belarus or simply give up on Uzbekistan? I think it's wrong to give up on Belarus, and I think it's wrong to give up on Uzbekistan, and I think it's very wrong to interpret the Andijan events as the over-enthusiastic response of Andijan residents to the Kyrgyz Revolution. It was a very distinct event that was that resulted in government massacre, and that's what happened. But you had a lot of people who did what was essential in every revolution. They stood up, they stopped fearing, and they went to the square. And that, to me, has been the only common element in all the revolutions.
Mm-hmm. Albert?
Thank you. I'm Albert Savalas with USAID, though I should say I've worked at USIP with Yoav and with OTPOR and Freedom House and several other groups here. I want to respond to something Yoav said and also something Dan said. While Stalin did say organize, 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 or was it Lenin?
Lenin.
Thank you.
you could actually right.
The reason it's mentioned is for the simple fact that it works, frankly. And if you Google the phrase organize, 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 as I have, you'll find that it's said by labor organizers, civil rights activists, CEOs of major companies, and several other people out there. And frankly, it works. Not coincidentally, you look at a lot of military strategists, and Jack will be big on this one. Military strategy is very applicable to nonviolent strategy as well. Che Guevara, Sun Tzu, a lot of what they said, you take that strategy aspect of it, and it works. It applies to a lot of these nonviolent revolutions. Going back to what Dan said about the elections, while I think elections are important, I think that it's not the only thing, and indeed there's many cases, which I will leave to Jack to list, where nonviolence works without elections. I'm thinking of Ecuador's indigenous movement, where I just went to over the summer. I was in Ecuador doing research with the indigenous community there. For years, decades, they've been doing nonviolent organizing very successfully without elections. And there's plenty of other examples. China, Tiananmen Square, while not a successful example, what brought people to the streets was not an election, it was the death of a political reformer. So I think it's important. U.S. government funds have to go towards those kinds of CESIDs, and other groups are doing election monitoring. But there's also a lot to be said about just that grassroots activism, working with people on the ground, getting them, as someone just said, onto the streets. It's more than just the election. You're talking about months, days, weeks of work before that moment.
Mm-hmm. Please.
Hi. My name is Maria Steffen. I'm also from the International Center on Nonviolent Conflict, but I also wear a Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy hat, and I see we have at least two Fletcher grads on the panel, so proud that you made it. Thank you all to the panelists for your presentations. And I guess we have an interesting breakdown between those who are focusing much more on sort of the structural components and the structural factors involved versus the human agency component, the skills component. How much mattered in terms of the regime type, those factors versus the strategies used by the opposition leaders and movements. And I'm wondering if, in your research, you ever focus on that dynamic relationship. Or, for example, how much did what Annika talked about how the regime, or basically how the movement forced the regime leaders to make mistakes, how they neutralized the opponent's nonviolent weapons based on strategic choices that they made, how much that influenced the outcome? And is this something that you might argue is a weakness in the academy in terms of when they look at these transitional periods and they focus exclusively? And I've just finished a PhD at Fletcher, and it's always about the regime types. And then when there is a discussion about external aid, it's about how do we crack the nut from inside, meaning how do we, you know, check these boxes to make a regime less authoritarian? As I was listening to these presentations, I'm thinking, what is more important, you know, checking the box or getting skills and knowledge and know-how to opposition leaders to help maintain a strategically nonviolent movement that in the end may create a more democratic outcome? So where does the academy come down on this? And then a very specific question for Annika. When we were talking about mistakes made by the regime, well, when I'm thinking of mistakes made by the regime, it also makes me think of strategic decisions made by the opposition. You had the regime make mistakes, but how did the opposition make the regime pay the price? Meaning, were there certain things that the opposition did in Ukraine that would have resulted in a very bad set of consequences for the regime if it had used violence against the opponents? Meaning, why did the Ukrainian security forces really not crack down using violence against the opponents? Was it a mistake as it came out, or was it really specific decisions in a set of behaviors made by members of the opposition?
Some interesting questions. I'm going to use the opportunity to simply advertise the I don't know about the Academy, but USIP has been very interested in this question of how you do these things and has provided grant support both to Bob Helvey for a book he's recently published, as well as some friends in Belgrade who are working on similar questions. I'm going to turn back to the panel now, ask them to respond to these two questions as best they can, and to wrap up. I've had a quick consultation with Sergei Taran, who has defied the odds and managed to get here before the end of the session. But rather than try to hold everybody for his presentation, what I'm going to suggest is that we hear from him tomorrow morning. I've forgotten exactly when the time of the session is, but we're going to be having a discussion tomorrow off the record. I hasten to add, for those of you who may be from embassies are not invited, nor are members of the press unless they talk to me. We're going to be having a discussion of Belarus. I think what we'll do is ask Sergei to make his presentation at the beginning of that session. So let me go back through the panel if I can remember the reverse order. Annika? Either on these specific issues, which were in part addressed to you, or any other general points you want to make?
Just to respond to the conditions issue, I think one of the key things that the movement did in Ukraine was to take advantage of the conditions that did exist. In networking, they found allies they knew were very frustrated with the regime. General Antonets, for example, had been fired in 2002, and so they sought him out. And I think finding allies can be very important and that may have been a mistake on the part of the regime. Media attention can really help to heighten the potential consequences of a crackdown, and I think that refers to specifically to what Maria had brought up. They also really took advantage of the fact that they chose the wrong candidate. They played up in our Ukraine materials the fact that he was a criminal, and they presented Yushchenko as an alternative to that. They also did the same with accountability. There have been recent laws that strengthened accountability, and they really used it to their advantage. So I think it's assessing the environment and using that to your best advantage.
Terrence?
I think that when it comes to the issue of the crackdown, at least in the Ukrainian case, you have a battle of wills between the outgoing president and the guy who's supposed to be taken over, Yanukovych, the preferred candidate. And at least in the Ukrainian case, and I think this could be applied elsewhere, the guy leaving the scene, Kuchma, doesn't really have much interest in a bloody show. For a number of reasons, because he doesn't know how it's going to turn out. Because if he orders a crackdown and those security forces join the opposition, he's afraid of a Romanian revolution. And that was discussed. I mean, then Tymoshenko, if it was a crackdown, these two strands in the Orange Revolution, Tymoshenko, Yushchenko, are more moderate and radical, then the Tymoshenko wing comes up. Obviously, it becomes more powerful, more influential. So it was Yanukovych who was demanding the crackdown, and Kuchma was wavering. And all he was concerned about, really, was how he would fare in the post-Kuchma era. That was his prime concern. And he got very worried. One of the very good tactics of Porat was that during the roundtable negotiations, Porat surrounded his daughter's country residence near Kiev. And he was told about this, and that sent him a signal that we can get you. And he began to panic. So that... He, as a leader going out, I think that's similar to Shevardnadze in Georgia. As an outgoing leader, you don't really have that same interest in ordering that crackdown. It's the new guy coming in that maybe does. And the one support here that comes from the West, from the US, was the insistence, I think, from Colin Powell in the case of the US, was that if Kuchma, and I think he telephoned Kuchma and told him this,
that if you do a violent crackdown, we're going to put you on the wanted international list. And these guys don't want to be on the international wanted list. They want to be able to send their kids to public schools and private schools in the West and to access their offshore accounts in the Cayman Islands and do their shopping in Paris. So, I mean, these are real issues for them. They don't want to be like Lukashenko in Belarus.
Alexander?
I'm happy to say, as a former teaching a class in international law up in Boston, that we are seeing a globalization of criminal law, and thank goodness a lot of these folks don't know the law very well. In our informal conversations, there is this idea of accountability and this fear of leaving the country and being found, brought into courts not of their own native land. And we have seen this as a deterrent effect on some of the security forces in the entire region. So that's a note of hope. And I just want to leave with a thought that strikes me, which is this is a very academic debate and a very theoretical debate, but we are talking about a lot of individuals and a lot of people who are putting their lives at risk on a daily basis. And I really hope these lessons learned can be useful, because there are a lot of folks out there who believe in this.
It's to you, Corey.
Okay. Now, to return back to the academic debate very briefly, though, I think the most possibly a productive way to do this is not to divide it into the structure arguments and the agency arguments that these camps that you've set up. But what is interesting to me is to ask the question, well, what can be accomplished before the event itself that we're talking about, and how much of the situation can be transformed as a consequence of the event and the interactions. And structure and agency play a part on both sides of that, and you have a group of people who pay close attention to the event itself and a group of people pay attention to what happened preceding, and that dialogue needs to happen much more. And I felt that this was extremely productive, your comments and in particular Annika's presentation, to think more about what is unpredictable before the event and how much work might have needed to happen in Ukraine, because clearly a lot of that didn't necessarily need to happen in Kyrgyzstan. And in Georgia, I'd also argue there was much less organization despite the kind of things that Georgi was talking about. And so when I'm left to think about the scale of organization in Ukraine, it is just mind-boggling to me, because I think that does differ from case to case, and the importance of the organization might also differ from case to case.
Georgi.
Yes, I'd like to agree with Mr. Kuzio about motivation of the incumbent, that certainly it was very much true about Shevardnadze, because on top of everything, he had he's some kind of megalomania as the world class, Cold War era politician who laid the sort of, if not the crucial brick in sort of the ending of the Cold War. So it was certainly this kind of turn of events mm-hmm. would be very much undesirable for him. Another thing in that sort of communication with the security forces was on one hand there was a database of the officers who were either who had problems or who were sacked or who left for various reasons, and there was very active work with such officers indeed. But another thing was that there were lots of promises to those who were in charge on various levels in the police in particular, but with happiness I should say that almost none of them of those promises were kept and we sacked all of them, so 25,000 people from police.
25,000. Sergey, did you want to add a word at the end? We haven't had a chance to hear from you.
Coming back to this discussion, academic discussion, what is more important, structural conditions or agency approach, I think there is no contradiction among them, and it's simply describe, as if as a structural approach, describe condition under which revolution or any transition is possible. And the agency approach simply describe how exactly it was going on. So as I remember my academic years at grad school, we simply gave up all these discussions and basically we're talking about different things. For example, if you're talking about structural approach, I doubt that any revolution is possible in Kyrgyzstan or in Tajikistan, because structural conditions are not suitable there. And regardless how skillful the actors, what kind of analysis they have cost and benefits, it doesn't really matter because the structural conditions are not ready yet. And when you're talking about agency approach, basically, I think the revolutions can happen in Belarus tomorrow because the structural conditions make it possible. How exactly is going on, we will see. So I would not see any contradictions between these two approach. And coming back to this question about security and military forces, I think the decisive issue in Ukrainian case was that there was a decisive split in law enforcement agencies. Mm-hmm. Like half of security forces were on the side of opposition. Half of security forces were on the side of the government. For example, special forces was clearly on the side of the government, while half of the army was clearly on the side of opposition. Or middle rank policemen were on the side of opposition, while high rank policemen were on the side of the government. And if you have such split, the government would never use force, because it's very risky to use force, because you basically are turning the conflict into civil war. And it's very costly for the government under any condition. Even if they win in the war, it still will be very costly. So the decisive factor is the split of these law enforcement agencies. Mm-hmm. If you have the split, I doubt that the government would ever use force.
Mm-hmm. Let's try to wrap it up there for today and look forward to a good discussion off the record tomorrow from 1 to 3. And then we'll focus first on Ukraine for a moment with Sergei's presentation and then on Belarus. Thank you very much.
Thank you.